Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast here at peterbcollins.com. Today, we welcome back Dan Kovalik. He wrote the book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, one of the first skeptics of Russiagate, and we'll give him a victory lap on that. His latest book is called The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. And we'll focus on Venezuela, the scene of a regime change operation in progress, based on claims of an illegitimate election last year. But Dan Kovalik knows better. He was an international observer of the re-election of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela last May. We're also going to talk about the so-called Northern Triangle, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, where most of the immigrants who are coming to our southern border are fleeing from. And a lot of it's related to U.S. policy going back decades. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions, including Julie Dupree, Jim McHugh, Joe Clarici, and my thanks to Mark Shapiro, who just renewed his annual subscription. You can be a subscriber, too. All you have to do is visit peterbcollins.com, click on the menu tab, click on Become a Subscriber. You'll land on the sign-up page, and I trust that you'll know what to do from there. Thanks for listening, and thanks to those who support my work. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, Dan Kovalik returns, and he's just returned from Venezuela. We're going to talk about his trilogy of books, including the latest, The Plot to Control the World. Cooper Oaken opens the podcast today, and the subtitle of Dan Kovalik's latest book is called How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. And as we're still reeling from the allegations of Russian meddling in the 2016 election, it's a very timely book and a great read. I really got a lot out of it. Dan, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thank you, Peter. Always happy to be on.
And I want to talk about Venezuela as we get into our conversation today. We tried to connect last week while you were in Caracas, and due to the power outage and probably some internet issues, we were not able to do so. But I want to begin by congratulating you, because you were the very first to publish a book challenging the notion of the Russian hacking and meddling in the 2016 election. In May of 2017, you published The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. So I want to get your candid comments. How do you respond to the delivery of the Mueller report, to the limited spun-up summary that's been issued by Bill Barr to date?
Well, first, thank you for the congratulations. I do, you know, feel a certain vindication because, as you, I've always been skeptical of the Russiagate claims, to say the least. I've been skeptical. I think largely for those of us who have questioned the Russiagate narrative, the few of us who have, I think we've largely been vindicated by the Mueller report, which said there was not sufficient evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Of course, most of the media fell for the Russiagate narrative and have been pushing it and have been very invested in it. I mean, that's one thing that really has struck me. When the Mueller report was first released, and it was at least a very small summary was released on a Sunday. I remember listening to NPR that evening, and their entire hour was taken up by essentially, you know, kind of hemming and hawing about the report and kind of trying to justify why they spent so much time over the past months, you know, pushing this theory that ultimately, you know, didn't hold any water after, you know, what, $25 million was spent investigating it, you know. And so the press, the mainstream press, has at least tried to find some, you know, glean some victory in there, because they said, well, he still found the Russians meddled. Which I guess Mueller did conclude that, but I mean,
well,
we need to
see those details. I still await any public evidence of the central charge that Russian GRU agents hacked the DNC and handed off that information to WikiLeaks.
First of all, I haven't seen any evidence that says Russians did the hack, and there was some indications that had been given by the veterans, intelligence veterans group mm-hmm. that's featured on Consortium News.
Bill Binney.
Mm-hmm. That in fact, yes, exactly, that it wasn't a hack, but that someone actually downloaded it physically from the computer, meaning it was probably an inside job.
Right.
But let's assume some Russians did hack it. We don't know that those Russians were being directed by Moscow, right? The fact that they had Russian nationality does not make them agents of the state. And I think that's a point that's missed often. I mean, basically anything that anyone does who is Russian, the press tries to, you know, to tag Putin with, which is silly. You know, I mean, it's a giant country. Russia has 11 time zones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that, you know, every time a Russian sneezes, we can, you know, blame Vladimir Putin is silliness, right? But even if Putin did it himself, I mean, the idea that he hacked into a DNC computer and exposed the fact that Clinton was rigging the Democratic primaries in her favor and against Bernie Sanders, I mean, does not election meddling make, you know?
Right. Yeah. Just to be explicit, the information that you just referred to about the way the primary was run, what I believe was some money laundering and campaign finance violations because the Clinton treasurer was also the DNC treasurer, you know, that came out of the spear phishing attack on John Podesta's cell phone. And what has happened here is the conflation of the State Department emails that the FBI's Peter Strzok has since told us they were instructed not to look at the content of those emails for any kind of back scratching between the Clinton Foundation and Hillary's staff at the State Department. And so, you know, the contours of the investigation and so much of went on in, you know, of what went on in 2016 is suspect because of the way the FBI was involved, first in exonerating Hillary, then in reopening the investigation, and then, of course, in the Trump-Russia investigation, which began in the summer of 2016.
Exactly. And if you look at the indictments that have been handed down, with the exception of one set of indictments, which we'll talk about in a moment, none of them had really anything to do with election meddling or anything to do with Russia. You know, the big one was against Paul Manafort for his dealings in Ukraine, and frankly, his dealings in Ukraine, which were attempting to woo the Ukrainian government at that time towards the West and away from Russia. So
right.
it was. In fact, anti-Russian meddling.
And that has been repeatedly mischaracterized in the corporate media in this country.
Yes, exactly. I mean, they will just, you know, kind of say, oh, and he was working with the pro-Russian government in Ukraine. It was just, you know, and they give no context to that, and it wasn't pro-Russian, the government at the time. And in any case, yes, that has been utterly mischaracterized, as you say.
And your point about the lack of indictments is what is central to the knowledge that we do have, absent the release of most of the Mueller report, that Mueller didn't find that. And while people want to see, you know, MSNBC is still spinning conspiracy theories now about Bill Barr, and I don't trust the guy. He's a goalie who was installed to limit the damage. There's no question about that. At the same time, this is the structure that we knew about from the get-go. Robert Mueller is not an independent special prosecutor like Ken Starr or Leon Jaworski from the Watergate case. And ultimately, the attorney general has this authority, and Democrats act as if this is a total surprise.
Right, right. Well, and again, and they're backpedaling because, you know, the Democrats and liberal pundits have been saying for months, just wait for the Mueller report. You know, they put all their eggs in that basket, and then when the basket turned out nearly empty, now they're claiming, you know, somehow it wasn't a fair investigation or whatever.
Yeah.
So the only indictments related to the meddling claim are ones that will never be tested, and I think that's what has to be pointed out. So Mueller, I think, in a face-saving move, indicted a number of Russians for allegedly hacking into the DNC computer. These are Russian nationals who will never be tried.
Mm-hmm.
They'll never be extradited. They'll never stand trial. So the claims against them will never be tested. And I think this was, again, a face-saving move for Mueller to be able to say he came up with something related to what he was tasked to investigate. But he'll never have to test it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I discount those indictments because they'll never see the light of day. We'll never hear about them again.
And Dan, Mueller appeared really shocked when Concord Management, this Russian-based firm, pushed back and used the American judicial system to defend itself and used discovery to force Mueller to go to court to try to block full discovery to this plaintiff that was, that was fighting back against the indictments. It was interesting, and the corporate media kind of just sloughed that off.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you don't even hear much about those indictments anymore because, as you say, it, you know, appeared that those Russians, even though they don't have to defend themselves, were ready to do so. And as you say, it shot Mueller because he wanted to have a one-sided fight where, again, he would make these claims and no one would stand to defend themselves and they'd never be tested. And when you know, some of those folks called his bluff, again, he seemed shocked, as did the press, again, who you hear little about anymore on the subject.
And Dan, I'm speculating here because I am awaiting whatever they do release from the Mueller report. But my deep suspicion is that he's going to that his report is constructed to protect the deep state entities that were central to promoting what we believe to be a largely phony Russiagate narrative. And I consider Mueller a part of that deep state after 12 years as the FBI director and running a rogue agency domestically. He was pretty deeply aligned with Brennan, John Brennan, the former CIA director, and James Clapper, the former director of national intelligence, who seem to be the most reliable anonymous sources for most of the Russiagate narrative.
Well, exactly. And the huge irony here, of course, is that these people who you've just mentioned are now somehow liberal heroes. You know, these are people part of an intelligence agency that has done everything it can to destroy social movements in the U.S. For the past 50 or so years, that murdered, you know, Black Panther Fred Hampton. Probably had something to do with the death of Martin Luther King and was certainly investigating him at the time of his death. This is not a good organization, the FBI, and yet now these people are all heroes of the left. You'll even see of some of the left, and you'll even see people with T-shirts with Mueller on them or James Comey.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just silliness. It'd be like having a t-shirt with J. Edgar Hoover on it, you know, that was, you know, worn, you know, not ironically.
Right.
And people really lost sight of that. Now, you know, and now again, the weird thing, while there's so many things to criticize Trump about, so many legitimate things, people are now, you know, they'll criticize him for not believing his intelligence agencies when they tell him about various things, for example, about North Korea's nuclear program or whatever. Again, forgetting the fact that the CIA in particular has misled the president and the public on many such issues over the years, including over the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They misled John F. Kennedy, fooled him into supporting the Bay of Pigs invasion on false promises, and Kennedy ended up feeling very betrayed over that. Time and again, the CIA has lied to us. It has lied us and the president of the United States in a war. And now we're all supposed to take the CIA at its word. I mean, it's very strange how this Russiagate thing has played out, although really strange is not the correct word, because, you know, it serves the interests of the people in power, because it does whitewash these organizations like the FBI, like the CIA. And that's what Russiagate was for. Russiagate served. In that way, it has served its purposes. It has vilified Russia. It has led to a new Cold War. It has led to a new arms race. It has, again, whitewashed our intelligence agencies. So in that way, Russiagate has succeeded, but in ways that really none of us should be happy about.
And Dan, I want to move on to other subjects, but do you believe that there will be any serious investigation? Lindsey Graham is now chairing the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he's threatening to investigate the investigation. And I would love a top-to-bottom look at the FBI. I'd love to see serious attempts at reforming it, not just to protect the powerful and the inside beltway players, but the way the FBI has run roughshod over the rights of many Muslim Americans who've been framed for alleged terrorist intentions. And likewise, we really need reform of the FISA court. It was abused, I believe, in this process. But we shouldn't even have a FISA court, in my view. And there's almost no public official who's willing to venture that far.
Yeah, I don't see any serious investigation being done into the FBI or over this investigation. Because, again, it would be too compromising to both political parties and to the state, to the, you know, the government of the United States, which has many things to hide, and both parties know it. So I don't see them digging very deeply into that.
Dan Kovalik's newest book, as I mentioned, is The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcomes of Elections Around the World. And last week he was in Caracas, where there is a heist underway right now. The U.S. is trying to destabilize and overturn the Maduro government. Dan Kovalik was an international election observer last May in Venezuela. And the false notion that this is an illegitimate government, Maduro, is promoted widely without question by virtually all political leaders and by most media outlets in this country. Dan, tell us what you saw and experienced in Venezuela that's contradictory to the coverage that we're seeing here stateside.
Yes, well, first of all, there's this claim that somehow Venezuela is a country falling apart, that it's in chaos, and therefore a country in need of saving, right? First of all, if they were in need of saving, I would say the U.S. is the last country I'd go to for that purpose. In fact, there's a great quote by Eduardo Galeano who said that every time the U.S. saves a country, it converts it either into an insane asylum or a cemetery, which I think is factually correct. But what I witnessed in Venezuela was far from what we're being told. I did not see chaos. I did not see a society falling apart. In fact, quite to the contrary, while I did experience and see, electrical outages, which also means, by the way, and sometimes we forget this, water outages, right? You don't have running mm-hmm. water if you don't have electricity. You don't have internet if you don't have electricity. You don't have phones. You can't pump gas. If you don't have a lot of electricity, nothing works,
right.
You know, and I saw that for about half the time I was there,
mm-hmm.
intermittent blackouts of that sort. And in some societies, particularly those that were on the verge of collapse or chaos, you might see a lot of unrest in that situation. And I saw none. I mean, that's the incredible part. While they are confronting very serious problems, many made in the USA because of the sanctions and because of also possible cyber attacks on their electrical grid, the society's holding together. One night in particular, we were 6 hours from Caracas. We went to a town 6 hours west of Caracas in the Department of Lara. It's a big city. It's one of the we were in. It's about the fourth or fifth biggest city in Venezuela. And that night, the whole city was out in terms of lights and all the other things that go with it. And it was a Saturday night. And aside from the party that was happening outside my hotel window, someone drove a big pickup and used its headlights or overhead lights to light a party, and people were having a great time playing bocce ball, drinking, singing. Aside from that, once that was over, the city was completely quiet. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely quiet. You know, people are managing this crisis. It doesn't mean it's easy. It's very hard. People are having to go to the river to get water. People are having to find ways to get gasoline for their cars. I saw lines, huge lines, after the outage when it would go out, you know, once the lights would come back on, you know, you'd see lines of a half a mile or more of cars lined up to get gasoline. But they were orderly lines. It wasn't like people were fighting or whatever. These were orderly lines to get their lives back on track.
Dan, let me ask you, because in the mainstream media reports here in this country, they play up the role of the colectivos, and colectivos maybe is the better way to pronounce it. And these are militias or just kind of self-identified enforcers. They ride around on motorcycles. And the image that is created is like the Hell's Angels handling security at Altamont.
Yeah. And again, I didn't see any of that. And frankly, I didn't see that. And I didn't see much of a police presence. I mean, there were certainly police out, but not any more than you'd see in the U.S. and probably a bit less. You know, certainly there are self-armed groups in Venezuela who protect their own communities. And there are people who are arming to defend themselves in case the U.S. invades. I mean, as any people would do, you know, as we would do if we were being invaded. But I, you know, this idea that there's, you know, militias going around harassing people and whatnot is just not true. You know, these are self defense groups. Then there are communes in various neighborhoods who, again, police themselves. Though I think that's a good thing. And the irony is, a lot of people in this country would think that's a good thing. You know,
mm-hmm.
Second Amendment in Venezuela is alive and well. You know, I mean, in truth.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think, you know, certainly there is violence in Venezuela. There's been a high crime rate for many years, even predating Chavez, and you know, people do feel the need to, again, organize self-defense groups mm-hmm. or whatever, but I don't see that as a negative thing.
Dan, on April 1st, the New York Times published an op-ed video, and I had kind of a double take because I thought, is this April Fool's? But it wasn't. This is a feature hosted by a woman named Joanna Hausman, and she is described only as a Venezuelan-American writer and comedian. And her father, Ricardo Hausman, the Harvard economist, is really a central figure in the opposition that has propped up Juan Guaido as this would-be president of Venezuela. And the New York Times didn't even bother to mention that connection. And I regard this as pure propaganda. She's demonizing Maduro and speaking to American liberals who don't get it.
Yes, yes. There are a lot of things not said in there. Again, first of all, her connection to Venezuela, which seems very, very tenuous at best. And she doesn't, honestly, she looks very European. And again, it's not clear how long she ever lived in Venezuela, if ever. So that's an important thing. But also, as you mentioned, her father's a very key opposition figure who supports Juan Guaido, and who's a very famous neoliberal economist who supports, you know, privatizing everything and eliminating some programs, you know, which is really the foundation of the Bolivarian movement. And so, yes, to see that type of video, and I saw it too, you know, honestly, it says a lot about Venezuela in ways, though, that the New York Times would never point out. But, you know, the thing that's important to think about and keep in mind when thinking about Venezuela is that there is a class struggle going on there, and there is a real racial divide as well, which motivates both sides. And the people, by and large, who support the government, who support Nicolas Maduro, are poorer people, working class people, and darker skinned people. So I think it is very important to understand the racial issues in Venezuela, which are not dissimilar to those in our country, well, except with one big exception. Here you talk about racial minorities being oppressed. In Venezuela, the truth is that it is the lighter-skinned European Venezuelans who are the minority. And the majority, really, are Afro-descendants and mestizos and indigenous people all combined. So people of color are actually the vast majority of the Venezuelan people, but they haven't been treated as such before Chavez. They really were oppressed people. They really were people who were invisible in society, who did not count. They largely lived in poor barrios that were completely disconnected from the infrastructure of the cities, you know. So they lived in the, and still do live in these mountain, you know, in these barrios that, you know, you've probably seen photos of that, you know, climb up the mountains surrounding Caracas and other like cities.
Mm-hmm.
And before the Chavez, the Bolivarian Revolution, which is called, what it's called, that began in 1999, those communities did not have running water, did not have electricity. Many of them did not have paved roads. And they had no connection transportation-wise to the center city. If they worked in the center city, as many of those folks do, they would have to walk many miles down the hill back and forth to get to work. Well, when Chavez took over, he immediately took measures to help those people. First of all, he built in Caracas what's known as the Metro Cable, which is this beautiful, really ski lift system that connects those barrios to the center city so that they can move up and down those mountains on these free and beautiful cable cars, which I've used, and they're really extraordinary. He brought running water to these places. He brought electricity. He brought roads. And he brought electoral polling places before those people would have to, again, walk into the center city miles to vote. So for the first time, and the other thing he did is he gave a lot of land back to Afro-descendants and indigenous people, land that had been stolen from them. So it's those folks who feel very connected to the revolution, and despite the difficulties they're facing in Venezuela, are still very supportive of the government. And in fact, you know, if you ever see, it's those people, if you've ever seen the movie The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, about the 2002 coup that the U.S. of course supported,
mm-hmm.
in which Chavez was kidnapped and taken out of office for about 48 hours. It's the very people I just mentioned. It's the people of those barrios who came down to Caracas, who went to the Miraflores, the White House of Venezuela, and demanded his return. Mm. And it is they who really had him returned. It was in response to them that you know, portions of the military ensured his safe return to office. And it is those people who, by and large, still support the government. And it's the people, you know, the whiter skinned, more elite people who oppose the government. And they've opposed it from the very beginning. And now let me just say that the sanctions, however, and that have been imposed since 2015 have made it very difficult for the Venezuelan people on a lot of in a lot of ways. But one way is that they've been cut off from international financing and international commercial activities, especially since August of 2017 with Trump's sanctions at that time. And what does that mean for them? So one, those Metro Cable system I mentioned to you now is only half working. And why? Because the cables that they need, they need replaced to run those ski lifts, they can't get them except from other countries. I think those they get from Sweden. Mm-hmm. Well, the sanctions Trump imposed prevent them from buying those. So they can't get the cables now. So, you know, half those, you know, population in those barrios are now back to where they were, you know, before Chavez was elected in terms of their ability to connect with the city. Ironically, the sanctions are also preventing Venezuela from buying equipment they need to maintain their voting machines. And I say ironically because, of course, the U.S. claims they want to restore democracy mm-hmm. in Venezuela. Of course, I think it's already there. But meanwhile, the country who claims to be promoting democracy in Venezuela is preventing them from getting machines needed to carry out democratic processes. Moreover, the New York Times pointed out, as Chomsky notes, you kind of have to read the Times, read between the lines and also read far down in an article to actually find the truth. And in an article they had about, you know, the electrical outages in Venezuela, they conceded that in particular, Venezuela's backup electrical system has not been working because they cannot get parts to upkeep that system because of the sanctions. And so,
Dan, that's obviously yes. just a cover story. It's socialism. Socialism is the cause of everything that is wrong in Venezuela. Don't you understand that?
Yeah, well, of course, that is the narrative. And it's the narrative they gave, you know, time and again, like in places like Chile in 1973. You know, the U.S. destroys a country's ability to survive. Intentionally does so, starves the country out, and then blames the people for starving
yeah.
because they're socialists. I mean, this is time and again the game plan that the U.S. uses for regime change against progressive governments. And yet, even though we've seen this same game plan run time and again, people continue to be fooled. And by the way, I think that the attempt to discredit socialism in Venezuela by, again, undermining the economy in the way we have done there is meant not only for consumption of, you know, the global South, you know, to tell other countries don't go, you know, rogue, don't go independent and socialist because you're going to be crushed and it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also meant for domestic consumption. You know, it's not a coincidence that the U.S. has really ratcheted up its regime change plans in Venezuela at a time when people in this country, for the first time in many years, are talking about things like socialism, Medicare for the U.S. wants to teach a lesson to Americans, too, that mm-hmm. that those sorts of ideas in projects will not work. And the way they do it is by doing everything they can to destabilize countries that are trying those very projects and then claiming they can't work. William Bloom actually had a very good quote. He said, you know, it would be like the claiming man will never fly, and basing that claim on the fact that every time others try to get a plane in the air, you know, someone meddled to prevent the plane from getting in the air, maybe even shooting it down or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then using that as proof that, well, you know, air travel is impossible, you know, and that has been true in terms of how the U.S. has dealt with socialist, every socialist government that's ever existed. There's never been a socialist project that has been unmolested by the United States. We've never really seen how socialism could unfold in laboratory conditions, because the U.S. has always done everything it can to prevent that from happening.
That's a very good point.
And Venezuela is the latest example of that.
So, Dan, over the weekend, the New York Times published a story that the Maduro government has agreed to allow the Red Cross to bring in humanitarian aid. There's already tons of aid coming in from China. But the U.S. has presented this this optic that the bridge to Colombia, where there are barriers that have been placed there, that it was closed by Maduro to prevent the so-called John Bolton humanitarian aid shipment that was due to arrive and was blocked on the 23rd of February. And I'd like you just to explain to our listeners the history of the bridge there. It's got, I think, six lanes, three different paths, overpasses is what I'm looking for. And the New York Times has never been honest about the fact that that bridge has never been opened.
Right, or has been closed for many years. Right. So, right, a lot of the mainstream press at the time, shortly before that alleged humanitarian aid shipment went forward, showed this photo of this bridge with, as you say, semi-truck containers blocking it. And they said, oh, this is Maduro setting up these blockades to prevent the aid from coming through. And as you mentioned, the fact is that these bridges hadn't been used for many years. And so it was just a lie what they were saying, trying to connect the closure of the bridges to the aid.
And they're still promoting that lie by using this imagery. And it took the Times a full week to figure out that the torching of a couple of the tractor trailer rigs that were coming across was done by Guaido supporters and not Maduro's troops who were guarding the border there. And it was Max Blumenthal at the Gray Zone Project who immediately reported that the Molotov cocktail that was tossed came from an opposition supporter. And so there was a lie. This is not as big as the Gulf of Tonkin, but it could have been the basis for military action had things gone just a little differently.
Well, yeah, and as these things usually happen, the retractions are, you know, done, you know, well into the newspaper. That is to say that they loudly and and with great frequency talked about Maduro allegedly setting those trucks on fire. And then when, of course, it's very clear and cannot be denied that it was Guaido forces who did it, you hear a very brief retraction and then that's gone. And so if you blinked, you'd miss it. And that's the whole point. You know, many people still believe, even in Venezuela, that Maduro did it because there was so much press coverage given to it and so little given to the retraction. Moreover, as Glenn Greenwald pointed out, the fonts of the claim that it was Maduro who had done it, or Maduro forces who had done who had lit those fires on the aid trucks, came from CNN.
Yeah.
And they had people on the ground who lied. It wasn't a mistake. They lied. They said they saw Maduro forces do it, and they couldn't have seen it because they didn't do it. And it came from inside Colombia, not from the Venezuela side. And so, you know, you see lies being promoted in order to justify regime change, just like the Gulf of Tonkin, as you noted. I mean, this really could have been a Gulf of Tonkin. And that, by the way, was the whole point of the aid to begin with,
sure.
just as Maduro said. Mm-hmm. And frankly, just as the Red Cross said, the Red Cross and the UN both said, this is not a humanitarian gesture. This is a political gesture being done. You can't claim to give a country $20 million of aid, which is going to last a handful of people a few weeks, while you're costing their economy billions of dollars through sanctions. That's not humanitarian aid. And we now have it proven, proof positive, that it was a Trojan horse to legitimize intervention. We know it because the people who were calling for the aid are the people who set those trucks on fire. This was a stunt. This was a political stunt, and it didn't work, not entirely, but it worked to continue to vilify Maduro. Because again, the stench of that claim that his people set it on fire still lingers in the air. Because most people won't know that that story was false. They just, you know, will continue to believe that Maduro did it. And again, plenty. I just got back from Venezuela, and there's still people there who believe that he did it. Because, mm-hmm. again, the claims about that were much more loudly given. And so, you know, it's a very nefarious thing that's happening. And if this is a just intervention, you don't have to base it on lies, right? Things should be able to stand on their own. But it's not a just intervention, and it's not justified. And so they have to continue to make up lies to do that. One other thing I want to point out, I think it's important to talk about, because I've given this a lot of thought. In connection with the alleged humanitarian aid maneuver, you had this kind of strange figure pop up, and that's this Richard Branson, right, who owns the Virgin Group.
Yeah.
He held this
concert.
This concert, this benefit concert for Venezuela at the same time, the same day that they were, frankly, burning aid in trucks, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, why Richard Branson? It's a very interesting thing. So, first of all the humanitarian issues in the world, and there's many, including in this country, we have 40 million people who are live in poverty.
And Yemen, where there are 14 million on the verge of starvation.
Right, thanks to U.S.-Saudi policies there. Branson decides this is going to be his issue, right? And the thing that's interesting about Branson is that his Virgin Group includes Virgin Galactic, which is his space program.
Right.
You know, he's now developing these spaceships for space tourism for the rich for, you know, $250,000 or something. You can go out into space. But it's not just for tourism. You know, the interesting thing that's happening, and it's a scary thing, is that the super rich have decided that they are not going to try to salvage the Earth. They believe it's beyond reclamation or not worth doing. And so they are engaging in these projects, and there are a few. Jeff Bezos is also doing this. They're planning to build spaceships to leave Earth, right? And it's interesting that Branson has seized on Venezuela, and why would he? I mean, to put you know, jet fuel or rocket fuel into those spaceships, you need a lot of oil for mm-hmm. that. Venezuela has, you know, the most in the world, as far as we know, in terms of oil reserves. And so the idea that the Venezuelan people would control their own oil, which they do at present, is particularly anathema to a guy like Branson, who needs oil to get the hell out of a world that he himself is helping destroy. By the way, these rockets are incredibly CO2,
sure.
you know, mm-hmm. Creating devices. I mean, I hope I'm not going down a tangent, but what I'm trying to say is, you know, if you look at the people involved in this regime change, they're not your friends. They're not humanity's friends. They've given up on humanity, in fact. And the reason, for example, in the U.S., you don't see any infrastructure programs, despite Trump's promises, right? Why do you have trains that still go like 40 miles an hour and that are broken down, and you have thousands of bridges that are in desperate need of repair, and roads in need of repair? We know that New York City is sinking, imminently so. And there's no move being made to build the dams that would be necessary to save it. Why aren't these things being done? And I believe it goes back to this this issue of the super rich deciding they don't need to share this space with us anymore. You know, in the old days, the rich, no matter how rich you were, you know, you still needed to use the roads for your sports cars, right? And you still needed bridges, and you still basically had to live with the rest of us. And so you needed to do some things to upkeep, right? The things that you had to share, you know, reluctantly so, with, you know, us proletariats, right? Now they've decided they don't have to do those things. You know, they're now building, in addition to spaceships, cars that fly. I guess that's going to be a reality soon, very soon. And again, very few of us could afford those things, but the super rich can. So they don't need roads. They don't need bridges. And so that is why you have a the richest country in the world, the United States, falling apart, because these people don't care. And these are the people leading these regime change operations around the world. By definition, they are not trying to advance humanity or democracy. They are trying to destroy it. And they cannot be trusted. And it's just so weird to me that, you know, even liberals are trusting people like Trump or Elliot Abrams.
Yeah.
You know, the guy who covered up the El Mazote massacre, where a thousand Salvadorans, mostly women and children, were killed, who covered up the Guatemalan genocide. They trust him. They trust John Bolton. They trust Mike Pompeo. They trust the Richard Bransons of the world to bring about freedom and democracy in Venezuela. It doesn't make any sense. These are not people who are going to do anything or could do anything to advance those types of goals. And yet a lot of people are fooled. You know, it's very disconcerting.
Very good points, Dan. And I did look askance when Branson announced his benefit concert. It seems to have faded. I haven't seen much follow-up on it or any humanitarian aid that was delivered as a result on a Virgin airliner.
And by the way, he paid all these bands, you know, to get people to play a concert at the Colombian-Venezuelan border, which is not a place you generally want to go to. He paid them like $2 million a pop.
Really?
There's no – oh, yeah. There's no way. There's no way that that whatever they you know – because it wasn't a huge turnout he got. There's no way he covered his cost for that. That is to say, if he really cared about the Venezuelan people, he would have just given them the monies that he paid for that concert directly, because there's no way he came even close to making enough to even cover the cost of it. And so, again, this proves that humanitarian – aid wasn't the real intention behind what he was trying to do. Of course, it was a political stunt. It was all being done to support regime change in Venezuela. And as you say, no one talks about it anymore. Clearly, no aid's going to be given as a result. Again, this was all part of this elaborate hoax, a Trojan horse that was going to overturn the Maduro government, and it failed. And so now they're moving to plans B and C, and some of that could be military intervention. I would urge people to read a very horrifying article in Foreign Affairs, which details what that intervention would look like. And it's a quite scary thing. Thousands of people would die in such a military intervention. And according to Foreign Affairs, maybe 8 million people.
Really?
Will be displaced. Again,
and is that a plan that comes from the Project for a New South American Century?
Essentially, yes. I mean, yeah, the John Bolton, who's one of the neocons who, you know, was behind the, you know,
the PNAC,
the plan to, yeah, the other project for A New American Century, which was focused on the Middle East, is now the guy behind, essentially the new Latin American plan.
Mm-hmm.
And we see what happened in the Middle East, complete chaos. That is what was sown there. And that will be what is sown in Venezuela and surrounding areas if the U.S. Intervenes militarily there.
Dan Kovalik, I want to zoom out from Venezuela and talk about your book, The Plot to Control the World. You cover a range of countries where the U.S. has intervened over the years. In the introduction, you note that up to the year 2000, we know of at least 81 nations where the U.S. meddled or intervened in some manner, up to and including coups, covert or using local actors. Is there a scoreboard of the number of countries that we've meddled in since 2000 to bring us up to date?
I'm sure there is. I couldn't point you to one. This Oxford study that I relied on for the 81 instances of election meddling. And again, he didn't even count the actual coup d'etats the U.S. supported. He just was dealing with specific acts of election meddling.
Mm-hmm.
And he went up to, 2000. And so I don't know of anyone who's done a good catalog since that time. Of course, William Bloom, who was probably one of the better people to keep score on these things.
Yeah, he passed away.
He passed away. And his book, Killing Hope, even though it went through a number of printings, I think barely gets up to the early 2000s. So I think that book still needs to be written, and mm-hmm. maybe that's one of my next projects.
In your book, you detail some aspects of our intervention in Haiti. You talk about Russia in 1996, Iran in the 1950s, Guatemala 1954 and beyond, the Congo, Brazil, Vietnam, Chile, Honduras in 2009, Nicaragua during the 1980s, and Ukraine in 2014. And I really got a lot out of your book. It's not a long book. It does give us a good overview of the U.S. interventions in these cases. And as we wrap up, Dan, I just would like to get your comment on the role of the U.S. in destabilizing what's called the Northern Triangle. This is the region where most of the migrants are originating from, who form these caravans that just make Trump pee in his pants.
Yeah.
And last week, his Homeland Security Secretary went to the region, hammered out an agreement with those three nations to try to improve conditions there economically and reduce the amount of violence so that people wouldn't be motivated to come to the United States. And Trump just ignored that and is now threatening to cut off the nominal aid that we give these three countries. And some of that shoots us in our own proverbial foot, because it will cut the funding for some of the gang suppression efforts that are underway, the drug enforcement efforts, and other factors that the U.S. funds in our self-interest, not the nations that Trump is trying to punish by cutting off this limited aid.
Yes. And so essentially, the truth is that the migrant issue that we're facing now, as you mentioned, is largely coming from these Northern Triangle countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And it is a crisis made in the USA. We've touched a little bit upon it. In Guatemala and El Salvador, one has to look particularly to the 1980s and the war that the U.S. waged in those countries during that time, which claimed the lives of 200,000 people in Guatemala and about 75,000 people in El Salvador in a very brutal and frankly one-sided civil war. And I say one-sided because in Guatemala, the Truth Commission concluded that it was U.S.-backed military forces that carried out about 94% of the murders of those 200,000, I mentioned, mostly Mayan Indians, and that's why it is considered a genocide. And the U.S. supported that genocide. And when it became even too embarrassing for the U.S. to do it, they got Israel to do it. And then in El Salvador, the Truth Commission there found that the state forces supported by the U.S. Committed about 84% of the human rights abuses during the civil conflict, which claimed 75,000 lives and claimed the lives of an individual that has now been decreed a saint by the Roman Catholic Church, and that's Archbishop Oscar Romero, who was murdered by state forces backed by the United States in 1980. And this actually began in earnest the civil conflict there when Archbishop Romero was assassinated after saying Mass. And interestingly, and again, this is maybe a topic for another time, but the culmination of the civil conflict in El Salvador came in 1989 when U.S.-backed forces murdered six Jesuit priests mm-hmm. in El Salvador and their maid and the maid's daughter. This was really the crescendo of the U.S. war in El Salvador, a brutal war aimed at the poor, aimed at the Catholic base communities that supported liberation theology, the theology that took a preferential treatment for the poor. This was a very brutal conflict that the U.S. supported, an ugly conflict that continues to reverberate. You know, I think Americans have to get this through their minds, and that is when you commit that type of violence against another country, particularly a poor country that's going to have a real tough time digging itself out economically after that conflict, the chaos and violence that is sown does not go away immediately. In fact, it may never go away at all. And so what happened, particularly in El Salvador and Guatemala, is that the people who were involved in the dirty war that was waged during the 80s, they became gang members, right? And they continue to carry out violence. In fact, Guatemala has more violence now than it even had in the 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, once you turn on the spigot of hate and violence, it ain't turn off so easily.
Mm-hmm.
And so those countries still feel the effects of those wars. When you turn to Honduras, they also had a dirty war that the U.S. supported in the 80s. And then moreover, as you mentioned, in 2009, after they elected Manuel Zelaya, who came from the business community, he was actually a conservative at first, but he became a progressive after seeing, you know, being president for a bit and seeing the conditions of the poor there. He tried to raise the minimum wage to create some social programs, and he was kidnapped and taken out of the country in his pajamas at night.
Mm-hmm.
By two generals trained at the U.S. Army School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. And the government that took over after that, with U.S. backing, has been very vicious, has been carrying out social cleansing, killing gays and gay activists, killing journalists, killing labor leaders, killing human rights leaders, land rights activists. That government is still in power to this day. By the way, it should have been voted out of power a year or so ago, and probably was, but it's very clear that the elections in Honduras were rigged against the opposition.
And we also know that as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton made sure that Zelaya could not return to the country during the period after he had been kidnapped, so that the new interim government, the Guaido of Honduras, could take hold.
Yes, and how do we know this? Because she told us so in her book, Hard Choices, at least the hardback version.
Right, yeah.
Because she excised that from the paperback version. Because she was surprised that people took umbrage at the admission that she helped support that coup.
Yeah.
And so we see the results of all these terrible deeds in these countries in the migration of these people to the United States. And now they continue to be abused, trying to find some respite from the chaos the U.S. has sown. They come here, have their children taken from them, the children who we find out are being subject to sexual abuse. It's a really incredible thing. And again, that the U.S. claims any concern for the humanity of people in Central and South America while they do such things, claim that they're going to intervene in a country like Venezuela to bring human rights and democracy. It doesn't even pass the laugh test. It's a joke, but it's a very cruel joke. And people need to catch on to that.
Well, Dan, I really appreciate your commentary and your candid descriptions of these situations and exposing the U.S. role in the destabilization of these countries that is totally ignored in the contemporary coverage of the problems that we just aired out that have resulted. Dan, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for joining me today. I highly recommend his latest book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Dan Kovalik, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for listening to my in-depth conversation with author Dan Kovalik. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.